3. On December 1st in Cincinnati, at his first rally on his election thank you tour, Trump announced, "We are going to appoint Mad Dog Mattis as our Secretary of Defense." The name Mad Dog was going to stick. For his second thank you rally in Fayetteville, North Carolina the following week, the president-elect asked Mattis to join him as he formally introduced him as his nominee for Secretary of Defense on December 6th. The event was being held near Fort Bragg, the home of the Army Special Operations Command and the famed 82nd Airborne Division. Bad weather kept them from flying in, so Mattis joined Trump for the long car ride in the rain through the North Carolina woods. At one point, Trump confided he had chosen Rex Tillerson to be his Secretary of State. "Tillerson will be great, perfect," Trump said, gushing about the Exxon CEO. "This man has presence. He'd run one of the world's largest, most successful organizations. Not part of the Washington establishment, untainted by the swamp. He was a dealmaker who negotiated oil contracts all over the world, including billions with Russia. For years, he has negotiated with Putin, who awarded him the Russian Order of Friendship." Trump spoke as if he had hired the Michael Jordan of diplomacy. He loved that the Tillerson pick would defy all the conventional wisdom. Mattis had never heard Trump talk about anyone with such admiration and respect. "God," Mattis thought, "this is going to be great." Since his retirement from the Marines 3 years earlier, Mattis had spent a good deal of time as a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, a conservative public policy think tank at Stanford University. Hoover had begun as a library started by President Herbert Hoover and was a comfortable perch for Mattis, who had 7,000 books in his personal library and was often referred to as the warrior monk. At Hoover, he had befriended George Shultz, Treasury Secretary under Nixon and Secretary of State under Reagan. Mattis was struck by an admonition in Shultz's memoir about the necessity of having a stiff spine. When you disagreed with the president you served, you had to preserve your independence and hold your ground. "To do the job well, you can't want it too much," Shultz told Mattis as he left Hoover. After spending Christmas with his mother in Richland, Washington, Mattis flew to Washington, D.C. He heard Tillerson was in town, too, and called him at his hotel on December 28th. "This is Jim Mattis," he said. They hadn't met, but we might be working together. "Let me buy you dinner," Tillerson said. "I'm living at the Jefferson Hotel. Why don't you come on over tonight?" Mattis, habitually early, was the first to arrive at the hotel's Michelin-starred Plume restaurant. He slid into his seat at a special table set aside by staff in a discreet alcove in the back to give them privacy. When Tillerson arrived and was shown to the alcove, he noticed Mattis was wearing a white shirt and a tie but no jacket. When Mattis stood, Tillerson glanced at his blue jeans and tennis shoes. "You and I are going to get along," Tillerson said. Tillerson believed you needed to know someone's life story, their early years, to really understand who they were. He shared his. Raised in a lower middle-class family in Texas, Tillerson had worked as a busboy and a janitor and had picked cotton on the weekends. His father delivered milk in a truck. Central to his life, Tillerson said, were the Boy Scouts. He had been an Eagle Scout and, most recently, president of the National Boy Scouts. "Have you got family that are coming back to Washington with you?" Tillerson asked. "Never been married," Mattis said. "I was married to the Marine Corps." He gave a summary of his 40-year career from the very bottom to 4 stars. In some ways, Tillerson had also been wed to one institution. "At Exxon, I was always just so pleased to get a paycheck every 2 weeks," Tillerson said. "They moved me around so much. By the time that I'd started figuring what I was doing, they'd move me to something I knew nothing about, and I'd have to start all over." They turned to their international experience. Mattis had served in the Gulf War and in Afghanistan and Iraq before rising to CENTCOM commander. Tillerson said he knew the world, having lived in Yemen, where he had run Exxon operations. It's almost like I've been on a 40-year listening tour. On Russia, Tillerson told Mattis about his longtime relationship with Putin, providing a shorter version than the one he had given Trump. But his bottom line was the same. The new president would have an opening with Putin and could perhaps even develop a constructive relationship. Mattis did not agree with Tillerson. For him, Russia, especially when it aligned with China, remained an ongoing threat and was not to be trusted. Mattis and Tillerson were on a path neither could have possibly imagined 6 weeks earlier. They gingerly acknowledged that Trump might be a difficult boss. The new president was a student of Roy Cohn's epic counterattacks, a bankrupt casino owner, a womanizer, and a reality television star of The Apprentice who clearly relished bestowing the trademark, "You're fired," on contestants. Mattis proposed an idea born of experience. Over the last 40 years, Mattis said, there had been some years when relations between the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense had been so bad they did not speak to each other or even so much as cross the Potomac River and shake hands. "Jim," Tillerson said, "how can that be? I understand they might not like each other, but a collapsed working relationship seemed impossible and counterproductive." Mattis explained there was nearly always tension between state and defense. For example, Secretary of State George Shultz complained privately that Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger was wary and reluctant to use the military other than to deter the Soviet Union and prevent World War III. Even as the leader of the Defense Department, he wanted diplomacy to solve all other problems around the world. Shultz, in contrast, believed power and diplomacy needed to work in tandem. He characterized his difference with Weinberger as a battle royal. Mattis said the one exception he had witnessed to state defense combat occurred when he was a colonel and military assistant to Secretaries of Defense William Perry and William Cohen during the later Bill Clinton years from 1996 to 1998. At the time, Madeleine Albright was Secretary of State and Sandy Berger was National Security Advisor. The trio of Albright, Cohen, and Berger had regular lunches and meetings. "Every week, they settled things," Mattis said. Because President Clinton was focused on domestic matters and then later consumed by the Whitewater investigation and his eventual impeachment for lying about an affair with White House intern Monica Lewinsky, foreign and defense policy received little presidential attention. If the three, Cohen, Albright, and Berger, presented a united front with a recommended course of action, Clinton would approve. "The issues were probably appropriate that they be settled that way," Mattis told Tillerson. The process served the interests, Mattis believed, of both Clinton and the foreign policy team. A vivid example occurred in the middle of the impeachment of Clinton in December 1998. Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein had repeatedly refused to admit weapons inspectors into facilities suspected of making weapons of mass destruction, as required by a United Nations resolution. Cohen and the others told Clinton he had to bomb Iraq to establish his credibility and prove the United States was serious. The Secretary of Defense proposed an operation called Desert Fox, consisting of 650 bomber or missile sorties against 100 targets. This was no pinprick like Reagan's 11-minute bombing of Libya by 30 Air Force and Navy bombers. Clintonites in the White House were worried such a military action would be seen as a wag-the-dog tactic to distract from impeachment. Cohen, backed by Albright and Berger, argued the opposite. "A failure to take action now will undercut our credibility," Secretary Cohen told Clinton at a National Security Council meeting. "Our word is at stake. If we don't carry it out, we're going to be tested in the future. If you don't act here, the next argument will be that you're paralyzed by the impeachment proceedings." Clinton acquiesced. I can't consider anything else, he said. I have no choice. Desert Fox lasted 3 days. The operation killed or wounded 1,400 Iraqi military personnel, according to U.S. estimates. Saddam's ambitions were tamed for several years. We should work together in a similar way, Mattis said. I think our foreign policy has been militarized over the last 20 years. Too many wars, too many military actions. I have seen too many boys die. Mattis had a startling proposal for Tillerson. I want you in the lead on foreign policy. I'll tell you what we can do, what I can't do. I'll tell you the risks. But when we get done, I don't want the White House sorting it out between the two of us. You and I will sort it all out, and so let's meet weekly. Let's talk as often as necessary. When we walk in the White House, we're joined at the hip. Mattis held two fingers together to illustrate the unity. That's the way it is. Tillerson loved the plan. I promise, he said. I don't know how to even begin to formulate solutions to some of our foreign policy challenges if I don't have the military standing right up against my back. He arched his back and placed his hand on his spine for support. Otherwise, the guys, the foreign diplomats I'm talking to, aren't going to pay a bit of attention to me. You're going to be in the driver's seat for foreign policy, Mattis said. The bus would be driven by State Department diplomats. Mattis would enhance the power of the diplomats by pressuring the military side, being tough. Any country dealing with us would listen to their diplomats because they didn't want to deal with me, Mattis, and the powerful U.S. military. Tillerson saw they had quickly closed on a working agreement. State and defense would never go into a National Security Council meeting without having worked out a common position. If an open issue existed, they would find a common position. As a general, Mattis's job had been to carry out orders from the civilians, President, Secretary of Defense, and National Security Council. But now, he had to shift. He was no longer there just to carry out policy. No cheery aye aye, sir. Tillerson and he were there to construct policy. Mattis was surprised how simpatico he felt with Tillerson. He just knew he could work with him. Sometimes you sit down with someone and you know you can trust them. Mattis continued, My job is to try to keep the peace, or what passes for peace in this troubled world. Mattis often liked to say, Keep the peace one more year, one more month, one more day, one more hour, as you guys, diplomats, work your magic. America is still an inspiration, he added, but intimidation is necessary. That's what I exist for. But it should generally be the last resort. Both men left Plume confident they would make it work between state and defense. Mattis spent the first 3 weeks in Washington preparing for his confirmation hearings, a period normally focused on meetings with senators who would vote on his nomination. Republican senators found him appealing, a consummate professional. But he quickly met a wall of silence from the Democrats in Congress. Not even routine courtesy calls. Then endorsements came from former Republican Defense Secretaries Donald Rumsfeld and Robert Gates and former Democratic Defense Secretary Leon Panetta. Word began to spread that Mattis was the good Trump nominee. Suddenly, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer opened the door. Mattis experienced an unexpected flood of attention. The Democrats couldn't see enough of him. He even met with Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders and Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, bringing to about 50 the number of senators he met with from both parties. He seemed to be on a good footing for his confirmation. During the confirmation process, the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency gave him in-depth briefings, but protocol prevented any real contact with senior military leaders in the Pentagon. He could not presume he would be confirmed. But Mattis kept asking for the strategy. What was the plan? What was the current theory of the case for defending the United States? Trump made many promises during the campaign. How would they fit into the overall strategy? But Mattis was not getting any answers. If he had learned one thing from his 40 years on active duty, it was essential to think these matters through, weigh them, debate them, test them against history. It was gut-wrenching to be shut off from such critical matters. Mattis received his waiver, and the Senate confirmed him 98-1. Later, Tillerson was confirmed by the Senate 56-43, winning 4 votes from the Democratic caucus. Trump gave him his personal cell phone number and said he could call him 24/7 and he would take the call. Trump also agreed to give Tillerson an hour on Tuesdays and Thursdays when the two of them would meet alone. Also, on Fridays, Trump would have lunch with both Tillerson and Mattis when all were in town.